ever-widening interval. Ah, whence is this? What is this severance? This silence pours a solitariness into the very essence of my soul. And the deep rest, so soothing and so sweet, hath something too of sternness and of pain.
James, you've already explained that this piece of poetry that you first heard in Elgar's setting was particularly important to you. Did it set you off down a particular route as a composer?
It kind of pointed to me that there was a way of being a composer, and indeed a composer that was able to draw deeply from this very, very same reservoir of culture that we're talking about, the Judeo-Christian experience. Messiaen was another of these composers who pointed the way and said, yes, you can do it too.
Now, Newman is very insistent on that combination of sweetness and sternness and pain. Do you think that combination is part of what poetry does in conveying the divine?
The thing that I find most arresting about it is the idea of this person carrying on, as it were, after death, and almost as an afterthought, realizing that these physical functions have stopped functioning, that the fluttering breath and the struggling pulse are no longer there. I find that an extraordinary, sort of quite almost scandalous idea, but very effective, very vivid.
He's talking about the sensation of having left this world, but is still using words which evoke our physical nature, and indeed talks of pain, which is a very, very physical sensation, and rest, which is soothing and sweet. I find these things very, very consoling, and I recognize in this view of something beyond ourselves, something of ourselves which is more than the sum of our parts, if we like, just which is, I think, what we all thirst for in our culture and in our attempts to understand us, who we are, that poets like Newman, but not just religious poets, will use these images and metaphors to point to our common humanity.
And actually, it's probably a tradition of all religions and all cultures. I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, everything from the Hebrew poetry of the Bible to Buddhist sutras. I mean, it seems to be a common language. Our next poem was written by a Jewish poet, Paul Celan, in the years after the Second World War. And actually, this is the one that opens for us one of the great themes of religious poetry, which is the absence of God. Paul Celan's psalm in a translation by Michael Hamburger, Khalid.
No one moulds us again out of earth and clay. No one conjures our dust. No one. Praised be your name, no one. For your sake, we shall flower towards you. And nothing we were, are, shall remain, flowering the nothing, the no one's rose. With our pistol soul bright, with our stamen heaven ravaged, with the crimson word which we sang over, oh, over, the thorn.
Michael, you chose this poem for us. Why is it important to you?
And for a number of reasons. Some of them are very personal reasons. I was a cradle atheist. And when I was in my university undergraduate days and began to lose my atheism, I was worried about the effect it would have on my poetry, because I'd always been writing poetry. And I thought, incredibly naively, that if I did cross the line and become a believer, my poetry would somehow lose its edge, or would become monochrome or devotional in a sort of pious way. I obviously hadn't read enough Paul Celan, or there are plenty of examples. I was, as I say, very naive about it. This is, I believe, a sacred poem, and it's a sacred poem because it addresses absence, but it addresses absence in a liturgical form. So it's a psalm-like address to God as no one, as absence.
So it's a very present absence.
It's a very present absence, but it goes deep into Judeo-Christian history, where there's a mystic tradition of the crux of meaning being on the borders of presence and absence, where that possibility lies. Is there a God, or is there not a God? And then you've got someone else, a great hero of mine, like Simon Weil, the French writer, who believed that atheism could be closer to true faith than a lot of believers are, because atheism at least rejects false images of God, the images that we've created that are just masking what and who God is.
But this is a sense of God in absence which comes out of appalling pain. I mean, Chelan lived through the labour camps of the Second World War. His parents died in them. What do you say to an atheist who hears, no one moulds us again out of earth and clay, no one conjures our dust, no one, and who just says, well, no one, actually, no one. Can you make comfort out of this? Can you make belief out of this? Or do you just say the poem is not for them?
It's not a poem of comfort, I don't think. I don't think you can take comfort from it. Chelan, as you say, had seen both his parents die in concentration camps. Bear in mind also, this is someone who was writing in German because it was the language of his poetry. It was his first language, but it was also the language of the oppressors who had killed his parents. So it's full of pain, as you say, and anguish.
James, the question of comfort, is that something that you can that poetry can offer, that music can offer?
For a musician, for a composer, that absence is indeed silence, the silence from which music emerges in the first place, the silence, that emptiness, the pre-compositional nothingness out of which music has to grow. So in the act of composition itself, in the preparing of the mind, one is aware of a sense of absence, but that absence is absolutely pregnant with possibility, because one knows, one hopes, that in that silence music will bud and grow.
And is that what you mean when you say that any form of creativity is a sacred act?
Probably.
You're off out to dinner afterwards, I know, to do the next bit of work together, aren't you? What does that piece of work look like to those of us who are neither poets nor composers when you two say you're going out for the evening to do some work? What is it? What do you actually do?
What do you think?
Well, you clearly have a good dinner, but what else?
Well, yes, I mean, although we talk today and on many occasions, Michael and I, about the sacred in art, I think that what we actually do is a very secular thing. I set a lot of liturgical texts for specific use in worship. But when Michael writes poetry for me, I always regard them as strangely secular pieces for a secular world, or for a theologically neutral world at least. But they are tinged with something that is deep in our backgrounds, our psychologies, and so on. I feel very privileged to be involved with the genesis of Michael's libretti at the very beginning. It's not often that a composer can sit down with a poet before even a word is written and be involved in that initial discussion. So it makes it very, very exciting.
That's, I'm afraid, where we have to leave it. Thank you very much to my guests, James McMillan and Michael Simmons-Roberts, to our reader, Khalid Abdallah, and to all of you in our audience here at the Royal College of Music.
Susan Hitch was talking to the composer James McMillan, the poet Michael Simmons-Roberts, the reader Khalid Abdallah, and the programme was produced by Allegra McIlroy. And a warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for this prom from the Sydney Symphony Orchestra and their music director, Vladimir Ashkenazy. Just one piece left on the programme tonight. It's Scriabin's Third Symphony, music full of rapture, evanescence, a portrait of the mystical relationship between man and the universe. Before the music, time to talk to my guest this evening. She's Margaret Throsby. She's here from ABC, all the way from Australia. Margaret, we were talking earlier about the fact that this orchestra was founded in 1932. It's made its home in the Sydney Opera House. That building is famous for its bad acoustic. A great building, but a terrible acoustic. How do they find it there?
Well, I think, like everybody else, that the acoustic is famously not very good. Many people think that the ideal concert hall would be the concert hall in the Melbourne Arts Centre with the exterior of the Sydney Opera House, because the Melbourne one has a famously good acoustic. However, they're going to be working on the Sydney one and bringing it up to scratch in the not too distant future.
Well, you mentioned Melbourne. From what I understand, there is this kind of famous rivalry between the symphony orchestras of Sydney and Melbourne as to who's better.
Between everybody in Sydney and everybody in Melbourne, they say.
But you have no take on that, of course, because you are utterly impartial as part of the
Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Well, I'm utterly impartial because half my family came from Melbourne, yes, indeed.
And just to give us a broader sense of the kind of cultural scene in Australia at the moment, it seems from the outside, certainly, to be incredibly vibrant, that you've got lots of generations of fantastic composing going on. You've got people like Peter Sculthorpe, then younger composers like Brett Dean. It seems like Australia is just buzzing at the moment.
The music scene is very, very vital in Australia, which is great. I mean, it really is wonderful in the Sydney Symphony. What's this?
Now, this is Margaret's first time at the prom, so I shall explain to her. These are the promenaders. And every single night they tell us how much they've collected for musical charities, and they get a large round of applause. It's one of the many traditions of the proms.
Fantastic.
Margaret is sitting next to me looking utterly delighted.
It's wonderful.
So you don't get this in Aussie concerts then?
No, you certainly don't. We're all very well behaved.
Of course, goes without saying. Now, the proms is live every night here on BBC Radio. Does the festival make any kind of an impact in Australia?
The proms? Oh, certainly. We broadcast them on ABC Classic FM, my network. In fact, this is going to air at a Saturday lunchtime. And we broadcast the whole series. Yes, indeed.
Fantastic. Well, Margaret, great to talk to you and fantastic to have you here with me at the proms.
Thanks for having me, Susie.
Pleasure. Well, as we just said, a few moments now before the last piece on tonight's programme, Scriabin's Divine Poem. It was written between 1902 and 1904, so very firmly in that fin de siècle period when all sorts of stuff about mysticism, the divine, the occult was floating around. Even so, Scriabin's own massive cult of personality was extreme for those times. He once famously said, "I am God." Scriabin was never one for personal modesty. He charmed fashionable Moscow circles in the 1890s with his impeccable dress, his brilliant conversation. Then in 1904, at the age of 32, he left Russia to go to Switzerland with his mistress. She was his greatest supporter. She believed utterly in his delirious messianic visions of delivering the whole world to redemption through his own music. Scriabin spent much of his later years obsessed with writing a week-long piece of music called Mysterium, a show involving music, dance, light, perfume, set in a temple at the foot of the Himalayas. He never completed it, so we shall never know what that work sounded like. But now we shall hear his divine poem, Vladimir Ashkenazy, back on stage.
Thank you. I am desire, I am light, I am nothing, I am God. The words of Scriabin, his symphony number 3, the divine poem, performed here at the 2010 BBC Proms by the Sydney Symphony Orchestra and conductor Vladimir Ashkenazi. An utterly authentic Russian fire and passion from the baton of Ashkenazi. He's 73 years old. He sprints onto the podium, I have to tell you, like a teenager. Incredible physical energy in his performance and a great sense of energy and communication between him and the players. The Sydney Symphony Orchestra led in that piece by Michael Dowd. He's the co-concert master with Dean Olding, who we heard leading in Ravel. This orchestra returning to the Proms after a 15-year absence. And Ashkenazi bringing to their feet some of the principals, section principals, trumpets, Daniel Mendlow, the principal horns, Ben Jacks, Hector MacDonald, all the brass section now on their feet. And applause for the leader, Michael Dowd. Well, Ashkenazi first came to the Proms in 1967 as a pianist. Then he played Beethoven's Emperor Concerto, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Colin Davis conducting. He's been back, of course, many times since as a pianist and conductor. He's a great fan of this festival. The Proms, he says, really raises the spiritual level of this nation. English music with a French title, played by an Aussie orchestra, conducted by a Russian. Proof, if it were needed, of the Proms' credentials as a truly international music festival. Elgar's Chanson de Matin was performed by the Sydney Symphony Orchestra and conductor Vladimir Ashkenazy. The encore to their concert here this evening. Well, as we said earlier, they are on a frantic European tour, 8 cities in 2 weeks. They've got a couple of dates coming up at Usher Hall, part of the Edinburgh International Festival, the 1st and 2nd of September. And Ashkenazy, the entire orchestra on their feet now. And that is it for this evening here at the Proms. I will be back on Radio 3 on Sunday morning at 10. I do hope you can join me then. Meanwhile, here at the Proms tomorrow night, Norwegian Chamber Orchestra here with Mozart's sparkling Hafner Symphony, his C minor piano concerto. Leif Ove Andsnes, the soloist there. Also on the bill, music by Grieg and a new piano concerto from Bent Sorensen. 7:30 live as ever here on Radio 3. But for now, time to hand you back to Ian Skelly.
Susie, thank you very much. Susie Klein at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. Now, if you tuned in halfway through that prom or even just during the encore, then a week today you can hear it all again here on Radio 3 during the Proms repeat. That's at 2 in the afternoon. Or, of course, you can visit the Radio 3 website and listen to it anytime you'd like to for the next 7 days using the BBC iPlayer, bbc.co.uk/radio3. And the website is the place to go if you'd like to share your views on tonight's performances. Plenty of lively reviews and opinions to read if you go to bbc.co.uk/proms and then click on the button marked share.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Well, stay with us here on Radio 3 tonight as Samuel Johnson joins the 21st century. What would the great wordsmith have made of our use of the word today? Well, in the second essay of the week, Freya Johnston, that is, no relation, considers how Johnson's hatred of fashionable and trendy turns of phrase that don't mean anything has influenced today's use of the English language. Telling it like it is tonight's essay. You can hear it at 11. Our next programme, though, tonight offers the chance to hear the views of one of the most perceptive commentators on dance, Judith Mackerel. She presents a very illuminating survey of the history and legacy of the Ballet Russe that dazzled audiences both in London and Paris. Not, though, just because of the composers and the dancers Diaghilev employed. Let's not forget the contributions that came from the many artists, Picasso, Matisse, Benoit among them, whose designs have continued to influence fashion ever since. Les Ballets Russes is at 10 tonight here on BBC Radio 3. But with the time at, 13 minutes to 10, we have a little chance for some more music. And first, the music of Chopin. This is one of his late compositions, the Barcarolle in F-sharp minor, composed in 1846. It's played here by Stephen Hough. exquisitely lyrical, Chopin's Barcarolle, Opus 60, played on that recording by Stephen Huff. Well, we leap forward 20 or so years now to the late 1860s and to a form of music that Brahms had been fascinated by all his life. And his close friendship with the violinist Josef Joachim gave him the opportunity to explore his love of Hungarian folk music and its many enchanting, seductive themes. One of Brahms's many Hungarian dances, that was the fourth of those from books one and two that Joachim, the violinist, transcribed for violin and piano, published in 1871, played there by the violinist Aaron Rosend and the pianist Hugh Sung. And it brings the time to just after 10 o'clock. A very good evening to you. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM on digital radio and also online. Well, next tonight, the dance critic, Judith Mackerel, tells the story of the infamous dance company, the Ballet Russe.
I'm here at Covent Garden because the Royal Ballet are joining in the world celebrations of the Diaghilev centenary. In Paris in 1909, the audiences were pretty much used to ballet as being a very moribund art form, cliched, formulaic, all about the ballerina's pretty legs, not about art. And Diaghilev brought this troupe of young Russian dancers and artists and set in motion this complete revolution that transformed the art of ballet. Among the works I'm seeing tonight is The Firebird, which was premiered in 1910, and which is absolutely critical in the Ballet Russe repertory and in the world's repertory now. It's a work that took the fairy tale ballet straight into the 20th century, with this electric, experimental choreography, with its clashing colours and serrated rhythms. It was a work where music, design, and choreography all came together to create a modernist work of art.
Spectacular. Loved every moment of it. Colourful, tuneful, beautifully danced, especially the Firebird.
I loved it because I really like Stravinsky. It's dramatic, it's spiky, it's really there, and it goes well with dance.
Beautiful movement, everything one can wish for from a Firebird. She was lovely, really good.
Certainly the rest of the audience tonight seem as beguiled by it, if not perhaps as shocked as the Parisian audiences were at its premiere. It still holds the stage. Inevitably, there are parts of it that seem, if not dated, then particularly of their period. But you still get this sense of this extraordinary historic moment where Russian traditions are on a collision course with the art and design and music of the 20th century.
I think it would be pretty hard to imagine what the world of dance would be like if the Ballet Russe hadn't existed. I think it's almost an essential part of dance history. It was a period of stagnation before, and I think Diaghilev just came in and created a whole new way of working. And I think we are still seeing that legacy right now.
I think the fact that ballet is considered an art of importance is Diaghilev's doing. The fact that you can have music by real composers is Diaghilev's doing. The fact that you can have artists of major proportions is again Diaghilev's doing.
I've been fascinated by Diaghilev since I was a teenager, and partly it's just the glamour of the company that he assembled. The dancers he worked with were amazing. Anna Pavlova, Vaslav Nijinsky, Tamara Kasavna. All of these were emerging stars from the Mariinsky, the Imperial Theatre in St. Petersburg. Even more impressive were the collaborators that Diaghilev worked with, some of whom were so cutting edge that they now read like a who's who of modernism. Composers like Stravinsky and Satie and Prokofiev, painters like Picasso and Matisse. His choreographers were Fokine, Balanchine, Massine, Nijinsky. What intrigues me, though, is what instinct did Diaghilev possess, not just to identify that talent, but to somehow put it all together?